Again, the title of the chapter is Our Ignorance. This was written in 1987. Let's see if Bloom called the future correctly. Sex immigrated to the United States. He's writing about how if you replace sodomy or sodomite with lifestyle, right? How many times have we heard that,
well, it's just a lifestyle choice, Mr.
See, everything is a lifestyle, right? You choose to be gay or whatever the case, or you choose to be a lesbian or transvestite or a cross-dresser or whatever the case may be. Let's just stick with sodomite, the gay guy. You choose to do this, and you pass this off as, well, I do this because I do this because it's a lifestyle choice, right? It's not a sexual deviance. It's not a sexual perversion any longer. It's just a lifestyle choice. Okay. So hold the thought that it's a lifestyle choice. And think of this. By the way, our telephone number, if you'd like to call the program, 844-527-8723. 844-5-CRUSADE. Sex immigrated to the United States with the special status given those who make scientific and literary contributions to our culture. But when it got here, it behaved just like everything else, American. Gone was the plaintive tone, the poetry, the justification based on civilization's dependence on sublimation. Just as we had cut away the camouflage disguising economic needs, such as the Parthenon and Chartres, in order to concentrate efficiently on those needs themselves, so we demystified sexual desires, seeing them for what they really are, in order to satisfy them more efficiently. This brought into the Lockean world the second focus of human nature, the one concentrated on by Rousseau, the philosopher, and those he influenced. The basic rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of property and sex. Give us your poor, your sexually starved, instead of your poor huddled masses, right? Freud made it possible to consider sexual repression a medical complaint and therefore endowed it with the prestige automatically enjoyed by anything having to do with health in a nation devoted to self-preservation. There is a tendency to neglect Rousseau's reminder that one does not die from not satisfying this hunger and that even great seducers' lusts can be calmed by the certainty of the death penalty. Thus, we demystify economy and sexuality, satisfying their primary demands, taking away what our philosophy tells us is their creative impulse. And then we complain that we have no culture. We can always go to the opera between office and bed. In the Soviet Union, they are dependent on operas from the bad old days because tyranny prevents artistic expression. We are dependent on the same operas because the thirst that produced artistic need have been killed. I cannot forget the Amherst freshman who asked in naive and good-natured bewilderment, should we go back to sublimation? To the sugar-free diet substitute, as it were? This is what happened in America to the sublime and all of the subtle meanings given to it from Rousseau and Kant to Nietzsche and Freud. I was charmed by the lad's candor, but could not regard him as a serious candidate for culture. Because we have come to take the unnecessary to be necessary. How many times have you heard, you really want to deprive someone of the right to love who they really love? How many times have you heard that? As if it's existential. If you don't, they'll die, right? Just like if Trump doesn't send National Guard troops down to the Texas-Mexico border, We're all gonna die, miniatures, please! I don't want to die, miniatures, a horrible death! Horrible death. We make the unnecessary necessary. What a great way to put it. In other words,
well, she has to transition. And if she doesn't transition, then you know, then she's not satisfying herself.
No, she doesn't have to transition, that 5-year-old girl. That 15-year-old boy does not have to transmission. The 13-year-old does not have to learn how to have anal sex via Teen Vogue magazine. We have comported the necessary with the unnecessary. And by the by, we talked about the communion of saints earlier today. Which one of the virtues that usually makes one a saint, or that thousands upon thousands of canonized saints share? This is an easy one. Purity. Sexual purity. They're not running around town slutting and harloting up with whoever it is that they have a dalliance for, whoever they have an attraction for. It is, in other words, I said this earlier, it's actually pleasing to Almighty God. Now, how do we know that? An angel appeared to a virgin in Nazareth in the year 00 or year 1 BC and said what? Hail, full of grace. Don't forget the virgin part of it. Obviously, God is pleased with virginity. And is pleased with chastity, and is pleased with purity.